Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
What's behind the ongoing American fascination with the Spanish Civil War? Adam Hochschild will tell us about his newest book, Spain in Our Hearts.
They felt, as did millions of people around the world, that the big danger the world faced was the relentless expansion of fascism.
How does Anna Quinlan address the theme of home in her new novel? She'll be here to talk about her latest book, Miller's Valley.
Places is your sense of experiences, your sense of connectedness, your sense of being loved and valued and treasured.
John Williams will spend a little time with us talking about James McBride and his new book on James Brown.
He was approached by one of James Brown's grandsons to kind of investigate the life and tell it in a way that others haven't.
Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Adam Hochschild joins us now to talk about his new book, Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939. Adam, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure.
So this is a new topic for you. Your most recent book was about the World War One and in England primarily. And of course, you've written about Africa and about the former Soviet Union and about South Africa. How did you come to this subject?
When I was in my 20s, one of my first jobs was as a newspaper reporter in San Francisco. And as it happened, there were two other reporters on the paper where I worked, the San Francisco Chronicle, each of them 30 or 40 years older than me, who were veterans of the Spanish Civil War, American volunteers. And when things were slow in the newsroom, I would ask them about it, and I got fascinated by their experiences. Over the years, I met a few more of the Americans who went to Spain. There were about 2,800 altogether. And then I kept encountering the Spanish Civil War in odd places. I described in my book, The Unquiet Ghost, Russians Remember Stalin, visiting a gulag graveyard in Kazakhstan and discovering to my astonishment that a lot of the graves had Spanish names. This was because any foreigners in the Soviet Union sooner or later tended to fall afoul of Stalin's paranoia. These were Spanish Republican refugees who had been locked up in the gulag and had died there. In a way, that kind of underlies the risks that Republican Spain took getting help from the Soviet Union in this war. But I found it an extraordinary, fascinating piece of history. So many interesting people went to Spain. We hear most about the writers, you know, Hemingway, Martha Gellhorn, John Dos Passos, W.H. Auden, Stephen Spender, Lillian Hellman, Theodore Dreiser. One volunteer said, everybody but Shakespeare was here.
Right.
So with a cast of characters like that, it felt to me very rich territory to poke through and look for people's stories to tell to bring this period of time alive.
You write specifically about Americans in the Spanish Civil War. I grew up knowing that many Americans were especially fascinated by the Spanish Civil War because my father was one of them, and he would, anytime we got into the car, put on folk songs from the Spanish Civil War and, you know, would go to reunions of the Lincoln Brigade. Very, very old men at that time. He was not one of them, but just to sort of listen in. What is it that you think drew Americans in particular to the Spanish Civil War?
Well, it's the only time that 2,800 Americans, a number that large, went off to fight in somebody else's civil war. And I think it was because they felt, as did millions of people around the world, that the big danger the world faced was the relentless expansion of fascism. You know, Hitler was making threatening noises about invading other countries. Mussolini invaded Ethiopia to seize himself a colony. And of course, as soon as the Spanish Civil War began, Hitler and Mussolini rushed planes, pilots, military advisors, artillery pieces, every kind of possible military aid to the Spanish nationalists, trying to help them take over, which eventually they did. So for millions of Americans and Europeans, it became sort of a test case. You know, can fascism be stopped? I think we have to look at it sort of as the first battle of World War II.
Is that just in retrospect that it seems like the test case, or was it really seen like that at the time before people even knew what was coming?
I think it was seen that way at the time because it was clear that there was a powerful expansionist urge. You know, as I say, Mussolini had already conquered Ethiopia. Hitler was making noises about expanding his territory to the east. The fact that they both rushed aid to General Franco and his Spanish nationalists was clear that they thought they would have an ideological ally there. I think perhaps the best statement as to why these Americans and some 35,000 people from other countries went to Spain comes from one American volunteer, Hyman Katz, who was actually a young rabbi who was killed in Spain. But before he was killed, he wrote to his mother saying that he could never forgive himself if he hadn't come to Spain because it would mean that he had not woken up when the alarm clock rang.
And yet, as you said, Mussolini and Hitler, they rushed to the nationalist side. FDR did not do the same for the Republican side. What was the official American position on the Spanish Civil War?
Well, the American position, like the British and French position, was that we're neutral, not going to help either side in Spain. But in fact, neutrality usually means something different when you look at it closely. And one of the things that I talk about in this book, which has not been written about very much, is that even though the U.S. did not sell arms to either side in Spain, Texaco, the oil company, sold huge quantities of oil to General Franco, sold it at reduced prices and on credit. And selling them oil on credit was actually a violation of U.S. law. Texaco shipped the oil to Spain in Texaco's own tankers, which was also a violation of U.S. neutrality law. So, in effect, the U.S. was providing some substantial economic help to General Franco and his nationalists. And only in recent years has it been discovered that Texaco provided a lot of intelligence information as well. The head of Texaco at that time, the CEO, was a man named Torkild Reber, who was basically a fascist. Was a great enthusiast for dictators like Hitler and Franco and Mussolini. And he ordered Texaco offices, installations, tank farms, agents in ports all over the world to send in any information they had about tankers carrying oil to the Spanish Republic. And this was, in turn, quickly passed on by Texaco to the Nationalist High Command, where it was the sort of information that bomber pilots and submarine captains could use to pick out their targets.
Now, Reber was eventually sort of found out during World War II for his ongoing pro-Nazi activity. What happened to him?
Well, he lost his job at Texaco because in 1940, which was during that twilight period when World War II had begun in Europe, but the United States was not in it, he, because of his enthusiasm for hiring Nazis, it turned out that German employees of Texaco were using the company's internal communication system to relay intelligence information about U.S. industrial strength and aircraft production and things like that to Berlin. British intelligence found out about this. We're not sure exactly how, but probably by eavesdropping on the transatlantic cable. And they leaked this information to the New York Herald Tribune, and Reber lost his job. He was fired. But he landed on his feet because General Franco immediately made him the chief buyer in the United States for Nationalist Spain's oil monopoly.
You mentioned earlier all of the writers that we associate with the Spanish Civil War, many of them American and European. There's also, of course, Picasso and Robert Capa, and just this sort of incredible artistic response to the Spanish Civil War. But your focus in the book is on less well-known names. Let's talk about a few of them. One in particular that I thought was really interesting is Oliver Law.
Oliver Law was a black man who had been a community organizer in Chicago. Not very much is known about him. He was, like many, if not most, of the American volunteers, a member of the Communist Party. And he fought through several battles in Spain and at one point became the commander of the American Battalion. He was killed about 3 days after that happened. But it was the first time that white and black Americans had been under a black commander in combat.
You say that not much is known about him. How did you come across his story?
The records on these folks, they're sort of fascinating sources that you can poke through. Because, of course, when you write history like this, you're partly limited by who has left what kind of records behind. And a great many of the American volunteers in Spain wrote letters home, and their families saved them. Many of them, if not most of them, that were saved have ended up in an archive at New York University. So that's one source. There were a couple of American soldiers who kept diaries, and some of those survived the war. And it's always fascinating when you can see what somebody writes in his diary differs from what he wrote in a letter, because the letters had to go through censorship. Another source of information that was fascinating to look at, when the international brigades, which included this American battalion, were withdrawn just before the end of the war, all of their military records, and armies, of course, run on huge quantities of paperwork, were taken back to Moscow, where they remained locked up for more than half a century. After the Soviet Union collapsed, the Russians realized that there was money to be made by microfilming this stuff and selling it to Western libraries. So everybody's military records are now available, and it's sort of a reminder of what an international effort this was. There was one American, Bob Merriman, who figures quite strongly in the book, and in the 25 pages or so of his personnel records in the files, there are comments about him in five different languages.
The New York Times plays a little role in the book in that they sent, or we sent, a major correspondent to cover each side. And they were not neutral, these correspondents. What happened?
Right. Quite fascinating. Covering the Republican side was Herbert L. Matthews, very well-known correspondent. And covering the nationalist side was William P. Kearney. They each became passionate partisans of the side of the war that they were covering. Each were completely blind to various faults that the side they were covering had. And they hated each other. And they sniped at each other in print in that sort of very restrained way that one can do in the news columns of the Times, where you obviously can't mention another reporter by name. But Kearney at one point erroneously reported that a particular city had been captured by the Spanish nationalists. Matthews knew it hadn't been, went there, wrote a dispatch dateline from that spot, and said something like, "In this war, there is no substitute for observing things with one's own eyes," because he knew that Kearney had just been relying on press releases and, in fact, was far behind the lines.
You mentioned that you deliberately chose this subject because it had been something that you had come across, obviously, as one does, various anecdotes about the war, but that it was a new subject to you. Yet, if you had to tie it into the rest of your books, is there a through line? Is there a common theme that you explore across this book, King Leopold's Ghost about Congo, The Unquiet Ghost about Russians under Stalin?
Well, I think the common theme is I do like to write about people who felt they were struggling or battling in one way or another for a more just world. And whether that means exposing the evils of colonialism in Africa, creating some sort of resistance to the Stalinist dictatorship in the Soviet Union, resistance to the old apartheid regime in South Africa, or the attempt to keep the nationalists from taking over all of Spain. Somehow what gets my juices going as a writer is when I feel that I've got a group of people who are struggling as part of what they felt to be a great crusade. It doesn't mean that they were completely right about everything. Sometimes they were quite blind to various things. But that just is what makes political events meaningful to me.
Thank you, Adam, again.
Thank you, Pamela. This was very nice.
Adam Hochschild is the author, most recently, of Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939, reviewed this week in the Book Review by Michael Kazin. Alexandra Alter's here now with notes from the publishing world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new?
So my kids, who I've talked about before, they're fairly small. They have a new favorite author, and it's Jane Smiley. And before you think I'm the most pretentious Brooklyn parent ever, I should clarify this is a book that she wrote for 3 to 7-year-olds, so they're right in the sweet spot. It's her first picture book. This is a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist who usually writes 400-page novels and long trilogies, but she condensed a story into 200 words.
King Lear?
Yes, it's a version of King Lear, but it's really about a little girl who goes to the beach and gets sleepy. It's a lovely book. It's called 20 Yawns, and it has the intended effect, at least on my children. So I love it for that reason. It's beautifully illustrated.
It's like the G version of Get Your Kids to...
Exactly. What we can't say on this podcast, go the bleep to sleep. It is illustrated by Lauren Castillo, who is a Caldecott Honor winner.
She's very prolific.
Yes. It's a very sort of simple, sweet story about a little girl who goes with her family to the beach and goes home, and her mother's reading her a story, and her mother falls asleep, and her father falls asleep, and the little girl can't fall asleep, and she gets all her animals collected and puts them in her bed, and suddenly, boom, she's out. So,
and this was published by Amazon.
Yes, that's another interesting thing about it. Beyond the fact that this is her first illustrated children's book, it's published by Two Lions, which is Amazon's children's imprint. And as you know, they've been really expanding their publishing efforts and going into every genre. So I think this getting a big name like her to publish a children's book with them was a big step. And it's kind of funny to see all these kind of prominent literary authors coming out with their own illustrated books. There was one by George Saunders that came out last fall.
Oh, yes. The wonderful, very persistent Gappers of Frere.
Which is such a great title. It's so Seussian, and that's for slightly older kids, 8 to 12. But there's also a book coming out in May by Sherman Alexie, which is his first illustrated book. He's written other YA novels and books for young readers, but this is really targeting the youngest of readers.
I know. I feel like, you know, all these grown-up novelists decided to write YA, and then they thought, well, middle grade actually sounds better. Let's go a little younger. And now they're like, let's just write a picture book.
I know. I keep asking some, like, you know, James Patterson, who's done books for every age, when he's going to do a board book just with one word on each page. He keeps... sort of,
too much work. Too much writing.
Exactly. But no, there's a few more coming. There's Elena Ferrante. She published a children's book called The Beach at Night, which is 38 pages long. And it sounds fairly creepy. It's from the perspective of a lost doll. So that came out in Italy a few years ago. And it's being translated and released here in December. So all the Elena Ferrante fans can get that for their kids, too. And so I thought this was kind of an interesting new trend when I was looking into this. Then I did a little, you know, Google is a wonderful tool, a little searching, and I found out writers have been doing this forever. James Joyce had a, you know, illustrated book. John Updike wrote 5 children's books, T.S. Eliot, Aldous Huxley. So it's apparently not a new phenomenon, but nonetheless, it's fun to see.
It's a very esteemed one.
Yes.
All right. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Anna Quinlan joins us now. Anna, hi. Thanks for being here.
It's so good to be with you, Pamela.
Your new book is Miller's Valley. Tell us what it's about.
It's a story of a small farming community that is under constant threat during the latter half of the 20th century because the state has decided it would be a great place for a reservoir. But it's also the story of a little girl named Mimi Miller who during the course of the novel grows up and becomes a woman in an atmosphere for women that is ever-changing and very different from what she could expect when she was young. When she's a little girl, she can't imagine what the future will hold for her because it's the 1950s and 60s, and there aren't very many roles for women to occupy. Her mother is a nurse, one of the few. And by the time the 70s come around, as it did for me, mm-hmm. everything changes, and therefore everything changes for her.
The name of the book is Miller's Valley. Is it actually the name of the place where Mimi grows up?
Yes, it is, but it's named after her family in that way that happens in very small towns. You know, little burgs get named after whatever family is dominant there. Her family has lived there for a long time. They're not particularly prosperous. They've been farmers for generations. But because it's been generations, it's by default come to be called Miller's Valley.
And you chose to call it that. Why? After the place?
Well, first of all, the place looms very large in the novel, and that sense of the place in peril. That's not just because the state wants to flood it and turn it into a reservoir. It's because those kinds of places all over America were in peril during the 20th century. We moved away from those kind of small towns and hamlets and towards the suburbs and the exurbs. And it's also a place in peril because the changes in our society mean that people like Mimi may not stay there. They may go to the cities or move away entirely in that way that's happened in America. This is very much a novel in which I wanted to write about the American experience over the last 50 years. I think we live through things in this country, and when they're done, we paper them over.
Right.
We forget about them. This novel is set largely in the 60s and 70s, and sometimes I think we've utterly forgotten any of the lessons of those times. And I think the important thing that I'm always keenly aware of is we might forget our national history. We might leave our homes and never go back to them. They might disappear under 40 feet of water, but everything still lives inside you.
Right.
And that's really what this novel is about, too, how, you know, no matter what happens to Mimi, the little girl that she was at the beginning of this book, she lives inside her forever.
It's a lot about how identity is tied up with place and with your childhood home.
Absolutely, but place is never really place. Place is your sense of experiences, your sense of connectedness, your sense of being loved and valued and treasured. You know, there's a reason why when we feel lost at sea and unmoored, we refer to it as homesickness. It's because that sense of where you come from is the deep anchor that holds you when things get tough.
The idea of a home being literally drowned is such a profound metaphor. What drew you to that kind of scenario?
I'm really fascinated by that idea of a town being wiped off the face of the earth. And years ago, I first read about a project on the Delaware River between New Jersey and Pennsylvania called the Tox Island Dam Project. They were supposed to build a dam there. And to do it, they had to persuade the people on Tox Island that they needed to leave their homes. Eventually, they got them all in various ways to leave their homes, but they never built the dam. And the idea of your home and where you'd grown up just being utterly disappeared stuck in my mind, in part because it horrified me, and in part because I realized it was impossible. I mean, the house where I grew up still stands. Contrary to popular expectations, it looks just as good to me as it did when I was a kid. I can walk through those rooms in my mind. I know what the wallpaper looks like. I know how the house is laid out, not because it's a house, but because it's a childhood. And so that idea of someone disappearing your town and yet having it still live deep inside you was something that really spoke to me.
And it's such a haunting image, too, the idea of a town underwater and sort of what's actually left there.
That is the ending of the book, her thinking about what's down there and to what extent secrets and answers are buried down there that will never again see the light of day.
You mentioned to me before that you've become kind of fascinated with stories about these drowned towns and drowned cities. Have you come across others in literature or in film?
Not in literature or film, actually. And I wasn't entirely sure that they existed. At one point, I was noodling around on Google because I wanted to understand a little better how dams are built.
Mm-hmm.
And I came upon this academic treatise on what they called drowned towns, which is a term of art. I almost jumped out of my skin because it's such a beautiful turn of phrase. And of course, then I thought, well, this is the one thing from actual life that I'm going to cop and put in this book, the phrase drowned town. But then I saw that there are ones all over the world, that there's one that I particularly was fascinated by in Europe, that when there isn't enough rain or snow, has a steeple sticking up from the middle of the lake that is where the town once stood. It is something that that really came to have a hold on me.
Did the book itself, did the idea originate with reading about that town in Delaware, or did you, or in the Delaware Valley, or did you start off with the character? How did you come to the book?
I almost always start off with my protagonist. Character is the single most important thing to me, not only in my own novels, but in any novel I read. So I started out thinking about a young woman coming of age during this particularly transformative time in American history. Most of my novels have been set in a very discrete time period. Still Life with Breadcrumbs, the last one, for example, takes place over the span of a year.
Mm-hmm.
This one, of course, takes place over the span of 50 years. And I wanted to be able to have a character who could grow and change during the course of that 50-year span. And it seemed obvious to me that to do that, it would have to be a young woman.
Was it hard for you to sort of get her voice right at the different ages and to think about her character as an 11-year-old and then as a young woman? And
I would say that that's the single biggest challenge that I set myself in this book. When you're writing a first-person novel, probably 80% of the work is being able to crawl inside the skin of the person. Once you get their voice, once I got Fran Flynn's voice in Black and Blue, I was off to the races. With this, I got Mimi's voice because I understood Mimi really well fairly early on. But what I realized I was going to have to do was to modulate and modify it, that her voice when she was 11 was going to have to be different than her voice at 16 and then her voice at 25.
And yet still recognizable.
But I think we do have the same voices. They change. They become refined. You could argue that we sand the sharp and interesting edges off of them, but they remain the same in some essential way. And that was what I had to play with, modifying her voice to suit her age.
So how did she come to you, Mimi Miller?
Oh, characters come to me long before I start writing. I walk along the Hudson River every morning for about an hour. You know, it's usually, in the beginning, it's where she lives. And then it's her birth order and how many siblings she has and what kind of parents she has. And I think the biggest surprise to me about Mimi, because I'm so used to writing about female characters who are more oriented in the arts, is that I realized very early on that she was this very sort of straightforward, straight-ahead girl who would really rely on numbers and not on words. And so the extent to which she was a science girl mm-hmm. was interesting to me, particularly at the moment in time we were looking at. And then, of course, you start to think about the people we surround ourselves with who are in opposition to who we are. So, you know, I began to create her so-called best friend, who is what we would call today a frenemy.
Right.
LaRonda and Donald, who she knows when she's a young woman and then later. And the characters just take shape. It's almost like one of those old Polaroids where when you first take it out of the camera, there's nothing there. And then slowly the edges of things start to appear and eventually you have a really sharp picture. But it takes place over time and it takes place for months before I actually start writing.
And you take her right through the core baby boom years.
Mm-hmm.
Was that fun, challenging, sort of deciding what bits of history to kind of pick up and incorporate into the novel?
It was actually really interesting because The truth is that life for women during that period did change so much that change and conflict are the essence of your book, whether your characters are changing much or in much conflict at all. And I also was taken by the fact that certain things that happened to her happened by happenstance. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of that in the lives of women. And it was really interesting to think about that and to let it happen as opposed to making her seem like some kind of heat-seeking missile. I mean, she winds up with a very, very good life in a lot of ways, but there's a lot of zigging and zagging on that road, and I think that's true to the experience of a lot of contemporary women.
Did you feel like that was your experience?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I must say there are some times when I'm taking that walk along the Hudson River when I suddenly get this flash of my life. How did it turn out to be this? And a lot of it does have to do with those changes in the lives of women. Some lovely young woman said to me the other day, "Would you still describe yourself as a feminist?" And I sort of blurted out,
"Oh, God.
Would I describe myself as a feminist? My whole life is dependent on feminism." And whether Mimi would say that or not, the truth is that those changes make all the difference in the world in terms of the life that she winds up living as opposed to the lives that her mother and her aunt live.
That's the one not haphazard part of it, then.
Exactly.
You're going on book tour next week when the book comes out. When you hear from readers, when people come up to you after reading your book, what's your favorite thing to hear them say?
It's not one thing. Frequently, a reader will come up to you and say, "I love the way that you use this as a metaphor for progress and the challenges of progress." And I think, oh, that's really interesting. I never even thought of that. And that happens over and over again because so much of writing a novel is an unconscious thing that you're doing that frequently when people analyze what you've done afterwards, they see things that you realize was it underneath the water,
right,
but that you had not excavated until that moment. And that's my single favorite moment.
To hear what they bring to it as a
yeah.
reader and what they perceive that you wrote that you weren't even aware of at the time.
But that turns out to be true.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the exciting thing, that they analyze it in a way that immediately rings the bell with me, and yet I hadn't even thought it until that moment.
That's what makes the book incomplete without the reader. All right. I'm hoping that your readers hear that and know that as you go out on book tour. Anna, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Pamela.
Anna Quinlan is the author of, is this your ninth novel?
Eighth.
Eighth novel. Eight novels. The eighth is Miller's Valley, reviewed this week in the Book Review. John Williams joins us now. John, hi.
Hey, Pamela.
You're going to tell us about the lovely profile you wrote today of the lovely James McBride.
Oh, thank you. He is a lovely guy. I met him a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about his new book about the singer James Brown, which is sort of a deeply reported look at Brown's life, mostly through a series of interviews and profiles of people he knew and was close to, including his first wife, Velma Brown, the Reverend Al Sharpton, who is a longtime close friend of his, who McBride talked to for the book, and many other people, including several lawyers since Brown's. I think the biggest story since Brown's death in 2006 is the fact that his estate has been really tied up in the courts in South Carolina. He wanted his millions of dollars to be spent on educating disadvantaged children in South Carolina and Georgia, which is where he grew up. His family contested that, and since then it's just been sort of an avalanche of lawsuits after lawsuits. And,
all right, let's scroll back from James Brown to James McBride for a second,
yes,
because
absolutely.
It's interesting that he wrote this book. He's known, of course, for his memoir, The Color of Water, and
yeah,
then
that came out
for
about
his
20 years ago, believe it or not.
Wow.
Which made me feel old, yeah.
That was a really groundbreaking memoir, I think, in terms of the sort of narratives of people growing up with multiple ethnicities, sort of mixed race.
Yeah, he was raised, he wasn't raised by his father, he was raised by a stepfather, but his father and his stepfather were both black, and his mother was raised actually Orthodox Jewish and eventually converted and founded a Baptist church in Red Hook, Brooklyn with McBride's stepfather. The memoir was really about his relationship with his mother and about her life in her own words a bit. And it spent, I think, something like 2 years on our bestseller list. It was a huge hit.
And then he wrote The Good Lord Bird, which won the National Book Award for Fiction in 2014.
In 2013, I think
it was. 2013.
Yeah, believe it or not. That also, time is passing.
Time is passing. But how did he get from the memoir to the novel to a book about James Brown?
Well, he's a real Renaissance guy in a lot of ways. And really, before he was a writer, he was a musician. He went to the Oberlin Conservatory for Music, and he is a trained saxophonist who played with the singer Jimmy Scott and other people when he was younger. He wrote songs with Anita Baker. So he's a very accomplished musician. And I think he loves the music. He grew up with the music. He was approached by one of James Brown's grandsons to kind of investigate the life and tell it in a way that others haven't.
And the other surprise, to me at least, in your profile is that he is also one of us, a journalist, a former journalist.
He is. He went to the Columbia School of Journalism as well, so he's multi-degreed. And after that, he wrote for the Washington Post and Boston Globe as a staff writer. He worked at People magazine for a while. He covered Michael Jackson's Victory Tour for 6 months. He was on the road with Michael Jackson and other people. And so he brought those chops to this book, and he did a lot of very deep reporting and spent a lot of time in the South.
One of the things I love, too, about your profile was the personal anecdote that he shared growing up nearby or next door to a house that James Brown owned.
Yeah, he was born. McBride was born in Brooklyn. He actually, I met him. He allowed me to watch him teach these children music at the church that his parents founded in Red Hook, Brooklyn. And when he was, I think, 7 or 8 years old, they moved to Queens. And on the other side of the tracks, as he puts it in the book, there was this sort of, at the time, seemed this giant mansion, this kind of weird, ornate house, and James Brown lived in it. And so all the kids in the neighborhood would kind of camp outside and wait for him to appear. And of course, he never did, being kind of enigmatic and private. And one day, one of McBride's many siblings, he's one of 12 children, his sister Dottie, when she was a young kid.
It's hard not to flinch hearing that figure.
I know.
But anyway.
she and a friend of hers, I think when she was maybe 10 years old or something, just walked up to the door and knocked. They said, let's stop waiting for him to come out. And I think a helper opened the door, and then Brown appeared with a woman on each arm and told McBride's sister, stay in school, don't be no fool. And then she ran home and told them, and James was very jealous for a long time that she had a run-in with the godfather of soul and he didn't.
So you spent some time with James McBride. What was your sort of takeaway? What was your impression of him?
He's a very friendly guy. He seems very down to earth. He doesn't socialize much with other writers. He teaches at NYU in the journalism program there as a writer in residence. But I think he now lives 70 miles away from the city in New Jersey. He went through, I think, a painful divorce a few years ago. His mother died in 2010, the subject of his memoir. And so I think, and this book took a lot out of him, I think, because he found the legal morass around Brown's life very depressing. So I think he's at a point where he's trying to, as he put it, get some of his innocence back. And one of the ways he does that is that twice a week he teaches music, keyboards and drums to some of the kids in the Red Hook Projects. And he does it at the church that his parents founded. And his demeanor with the kids is incredibly sweet. He has to be very patient. They're great kids, but they're also very distracted. You can tell that this is just a very private part of his life. I don't think he's ever let anybody else see it.
And he's done a lot of charitable work and volunteer work over the years. Actually did some with my mom, weirdly
really?
Enough.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. My mom once babysat for him when he was giving a charity concert.
Oh, wow.
Yes, oddly enough, for an organization she also volunteered.
He still plays music. He plays occasionally university shows, and when The Good Lord Bird came out, I think as part of the book tour, he and his band would play during the readings, and so he definitely keeps his hand in the music too.
What was your favorite thing about his biography of James Brown?
Something that actually didn't really make it into the profile was his respect for this woman named Sue Summer, who's a journalist in South Carolina. She's a 63-year-old white woman who is, according to McBride, just completely obsessed with covering the beat of James Brown's legal estate in South Carolina, and she's really the only person doing it. And she works for this tiny newspaper in a small town in South Carolina. And to hear sort of his respect for her, him coming from a journalism background and talking about how he never thought he would meet a journalist like her, that was kind of a nice warm moment. But the book is full of great characters. I mean, he finds the last living member of this band called the Famous Flames that Brown fronted in the 1950s, and he talks to him. And these sort of Southern characters who are, you know, nearing the end of their lives, who have seen a lot of music history, a lot of American history, and he really brings it alive.
All right, John, thanks so much. The profile that John Williams wrote about James McBride and his new book on James Brown is online. Greg Coles is here now with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
What's new on the list this week is that none of the new titles are series novels, although there are some familiar names and some unfamiliar names. New at number 7 on the hardcover fiction list is Helen Simonson, whose first novel, Major Pettigrew's Last Stand, was a big bestseller a few years ago. She's back with her second novel. It's called The Summer Before the War. Like Major Pettigrew's Last Stand, this is set in the English countryside. Unlike that book, it's a historical novel. It's set in 1914, so it's kind of picking up where Downton Abbey left off for fans of Downton Abbey. The Summer Before the War by Helen Simonson, new at number 7. Then at number 3, a new name and a first novel, Cynthia Dupree Sweeney, hits the list with her first novel, The Nest. This book made big news a couple of years ago because it sold for a lot of money in a big bidding war.
What's a lot of money, Greg?
Well, 7 figures, they say. She dropped the figure $1 million in an interview. At the time, it was just reported as 7 figures. So $1 million is 7 figures. Let's go with that.
And it's also about a lot of money, the book.
Well, it's about less money than the characters hoped. It's about 4 siblings who are fighting over a diminished inheritance. They thought they were getting a big trust fund, but there's family tragedy, and some of that money goes to support one of the siblings. And suddenly, they're fighting over what's left.
I'm about halfway through, so I can't give any spoilers.
And then there is a new number one this week, a new title, new at number one. Harlan Coben returns to the list with a standalone novel called Fool Me Once. He, of course, writes these kind of domestic thrillers. This is that again. It is about an Army helicopter pilot, a female Army helicopter pilot, whose husband has died, she thinks, until he turns up on the nanny cam playing with their daughter. So it goes into kind of her psychological frame of mind.
Well, my favorite French movie based on an American domestic thriller was by Harlan Coben, Tell No One, which I somehow can see like 5 times and still forget how it all works out in the end. All right, what's on nonfiction?
Only one new title in nonfiction this week. It is by the former Portland Blazers basketball superstar Bill Walton. He played for 11 years, but really only like 5 years of actual playing time because his career was plagued by injuries. But he was also a big college basketball star under John Wooden at the UCLA program, probably one of the greatest NCAA tournament players of all time. He's in the Basketball Hall of Fame, and he's now a basketball analyst for ESPN. He has written a memoir called Back from the Dead, partly in reference to all of his injuries and his battles with depression. He has said that he was close to killing himself back in 2009 when he, for a short time, lost his job at ESPN. Partly also about his great love of the Grateful Dead. He's been a Deadhead for coming on 50 years now. So that book, Back from the Dead by Bill Walton, new at number 14.
I want to say 2 things about this nonfiction bestseller list this week. One is there's a lot of really great nonfiction on the list right now. When Breath Becomes Air, 7 Brief Lessons on Physics, Between the World and Me.
Those are 1, 2, and 3, yeah.
We have Jane Mayer's Dark Money, Being Mortal from Atul Gawande, still on there for 67 weeks. And moreover, no angry political books for a change.
That is true.
What's going on? It's all on TV and online.
Yeah, here we are in the heart of the political season. In a presidential election year, in past presidential election years, the nonfiction list at this stage in the process has been dominated by the kind of screeds on both sides of the aisle.
And TV's getting all the good screeds. All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
If your family's like mine, they've got a lot going on. Help them manage with new cognitive health supplements for kids. New lollipops help kids focus on homework or chill out for a sec. Get lollipops at Olly.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.